I'd like to have you help me welcome tonight our main speaker, Tim A. from Laguna Beach.
Hi, my name's Tim Ayers. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Grateful to be here. Truly. 4 hours or plus. It's worth every mile. Worth every mile. Wonderful to be here in the Central Coast of California, where Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well, and I can tell because the smiles on your faces and the warmth in your heart. I want to thank Lee for asking me out. I want to thank Kendall for a fantastic 10-minute opening talk. That notion of being willing to go to any lengths is the foundation stone of every successful person's sobriety, in my opinion. And I'm standing up here, and what do I got? I got 23 days. How many days you got, Carrie? You got more days than I do. I can learn as much from you as you can learn from me. I also have 4 months, and I got 23 years. But I was taught to count my time that way by a fella out of the South Bay, Dave Barge. Some of you might know Dave. Dave's not with us anymore. He's gone to the big meeting in the sky. Cleared 50 years of sobriety. I met a fella tonight at dinner. Bob, I think it was Bob. Wayne, Ray. I'm 63, give me a break. Ray, so we got time up here. We got a lot of time. And we got a lot of months, and we got a lot of days. And Dave told me, count your time that way, Tim. If you count your time that way, you'll be close to the people who are brand new. So if you're brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is your first, second, or third meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome. But he also told me that if I counted my time that way, I'd be close to the people who were coming back. And those are the bravest people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the ones that come back, the ones that have come here and heard the message and had that peculiar thing happen where they thought they might be able to control and enjoy their drinking. So they go out and they give it another run. Must not have turned out so well because they come back to us. And they bring that strength to us. They're the strongest people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we don't shoot our wounded for a reason, because they bring us the strength we need to keep going. And so if you're brand new or you're coming back, welcome. I'm grateful to be here. I truly am. The South County First Saturday Speaker Meeting. And it's got structure. And it has its message. And so it has its fourth and fifth traditions that Bill Wilson talked about, that Bill Wilson thought was so important that we have these traditions. And the fourth tradition, that each group be autonomous so that it can decide how it puts on its meetings without any interference from outside forces. Put on the meeting the way you want to put on your meeting. And when I come to visit the meeting, when in Rome, do like the Romans. Now we've got a fifth tradition, carry its message, its variants, its version of the message of recovery. And so you have a speaker meeting and you bring speakers here. And Lee did a really good job of telling me what was expected of me. Because I'm an old school member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that when you show up at a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous, you better have a sport jacket on and you better have a tie. And it better be a collared shirt. I don't care if the tie's a bolo. That's okay, Lee. You can do whatever you want. You're the secretary. Right? And I learned that early in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I respect the podium. I respect the group. And it generates self-respect in me. And it generates self-respect in me. I'm a hobo alcoholic. I'm a hobo alcoholic. On page 442 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in that story, the hobo talks about how he was walking down the street and he saw a man. It was a guy he used to drink with. And that fellow was clean and he was sharp and he was wearing a suit and a tie. And it gave that alcoholic hope that maybe he could lift himself up out of the mire and the pit. My speaker meeting on Saturday night in Laguna Beach, we encourage our people with significant commitments to wear a jacket or a dress or a pantsuit. Make sure you got a tie on if you're going to the podium, if you're a man, right? The reason why we do that is because our fourth tradition and our fifth tradition is we suit up and show up. And we want to be an example to the people who are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous after having another turn in the barrel. So that, you know, they can come to our meeting and they can see an example. They can get a commitment and they can learn to show up. They can rise up through the organization. And then they can become elder statesmen of the meeting and make sure that it continues in the path that it had gone for 50 years. And the reason why that's our fourth and our fifth tradition is because when you want to get your kids back, or you want to get that job, or you just want to feel good about yourself, come and learn it at the example that we set on every Saturday night at Laguna Beach at the Canyon Club where I come from. We're going to put that meeting on tonight. I hope it goes okay. I'm not there to yell at them. I know they'll have cake. We switched our commitments. I told the commitment coordinator, I texted her. Nobody talks anymore. Kendall knows that. But I texted her. I said, as long as you have cake and you have coffee, you'll have hope. And you'll have a good meeting for the newcomer. And so they're perfectly equipped to do what we've been doing down in my neck of the woods for a very long time. So I'm grateful to be here. Absolutely grateful to be here. I got a little extra time. And I got to tell you, you're in exactly where you need to be. I had no idea what to expect. I was driving up the 101. I was going to, because everything is about me, right? One of the third part of the problem, right? It's all about me. Third part of the problem. It's all about me. And I wanted to take one out of Santa Monica so I could have the ocean view, right? And I thought, well, I better not do that. I could run into some traffic. And what if I was late to dinner, or what if I was late for the meeting, right? So I didn't do what I wanted to do. I drove up the 405, I got on the 101, I headed northbound, and I got to Summerlin. And there were signs along the way. There were signs along the way that all routes were blocked north at Summerlin, at Casitas Pass Road. One, you know, they had the freeway sign, the thing with, you know, someday I'll drive and it'll have my AA birthday on it. But this time it said that Casitas Pass Road was blocked. And then I went a little farther, they had another one. Casitas Pass Road blocked. All routes north were blocked. And I relied on a source outside of myself. I had my app, right? And so I'm driving northbound and it said, get off at Toro Canyon. And so I got a message, get off at Toro Canyon. And I saw all these other people. A bunch of them were getting stuck. They were getting blocked. They were getting blocked in the freeway going north. But a few of them, just a few of them, were getting off. They were ahead of me. They were ahead of me. And they were getting off at Toro Canyon. And so I did what I learned here. I got off at Toro Canyon. And I followed the people who knew what they were doing. And we went up. We went up Route 192 up through Toro Canyon. We came back down. And then I came back down San Ysidro. And I missed all the traffic. And I got back on the freeway. And I texted Lee. And I said, coast is clear. I'm good to go. Right? Because I got a source from the outside. And then I got some good solid examples. And I followed their direction. And I ended up safe and protected in the palm of God's hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And isn't that the truth of our daily experience? That all I got to do is listen for the source and then follow the people who are doing it right. And everything seems to turn out okay. So I used to drink. Doesn't sound like it does at Kendall. Sounds like I had a wonderful day driving. But I used to drink a lot. I started drinking when I was 12 years old. Neighbor kid and I got a hold of a bottle of Chivas Regal. It's a top shelf drinker right out of the gate. Didn't stay that way though. At the end, it was box wine. It was 3 liters. It was 5 liters because you could get a lot of it and it would last. And it needed to last. It needed to last. And I didn't understand why. Didn't understand why when I was drinking. But see, I've got that thing. I have that thing that it's talked about in the doctor's opinion. I have this peculiar response to alcohol. I have an allergy. And what's the nature of that allergy? I take the drink takes the drink, and I'm off and running. I take the drink takes the drink, and I'm off and running. And I don't stop till I'm done. It ends in blackouts. It ends up in handcuffs. It ends up in broken hearts. It ends up in disappointed parents. I didn't understand that when I was drinking, and I certainly didn't understand it when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not that they weren't telling me, it's that I wasn't listening. That I have that peculiar response to alcohol. So almost immediately, what happened to me is we drank to excess that first night. They poured me onto my mother's porch because I was incorrigible. I was no fun to be around because I just, you know, I had too much alcohol. And she came out, my mother, and she looked down at me. And she said, "Timothy, Carl, what are we going to do with you?" And she would say that for 27 years. Because I didn't get it. It's just the way I drank. By the time I was almost 16 years old, I was running with a group of kids, baseball team fellas. One of them was a big shot. He was my hero. This guy, he had it going on. Had a beautiful Camaro, and he'd always go to places that the other kids wouldn't want to go. So we were in the San Fernando Valley, up in Granada Hills, California, and we'd go down into LA and go to the football teams. Wherever our football team went, Ken was not afraid to go. And he always had a six-pack of Bud Talls in the front, and he always had a six-pack of Bud Talls in the trunk, because when he took the drink took the drink, and he was off and running, and he needed to have as much alcohol in order to sustain what was, you know, we were going to be doing. And everything was just so bright. And the future was just, it was right there. And on the 20th of March of 1978, Ken was standing in the driveway of his mother's house at about 2 a.m. and he took a .22 round to the bridge of his nose and he was killed that night. And I found out the next morning. And I was crushed by that. See, people had passed, but they were all old. And here was an 18-year-old kid who had his life snatched from him. And it affected me. It affected me more than it affected the other kids. About 6 months later, November of 1978, I was at a party in San Fernando, California. One of the cheerleaders was having a party. And I took a gal home, another one I couldn't talk to, drunk or sober, and I had some drinks. And I came back to the party and I parked the car about 6 car lengths from the fence line and 3 more houses and I'd have been in the party. I got out of the car and I headed down through Brand Park on the sidewalk and I ran into 6 or 8 fellas who wanted to have a conversation with me. And I took a bottle over my left shoulder. I went down a bit and I took a knife to my back. And Norm Alpe talked about seconds and inches in his talk. Norm Alpe was one of Alcoholics Anonymous' great speakers. If you get a chance to listen to Norm, I encourage you to do so. I'll listen to Norm on my way home, and I'll listen to Dave on my way home, and I'll listen to Johnny Harris on my way home tonight. But Norm had this particular way of identifying with the alcoholic, and one of the things he'd say is, it was seconds and inches for me. Well, it was seconds and inches for me that night. We just barely get through sometimes. We squeak through. We're the lucky ones. Sometimes we don't make it, but man, one bad situation after another, and I just squeaked through. And that night, instead of going down, I popped up. And I ran to the car, and I got in the car. And I was headed westbound on San Fernando Mission Boulevard in the San Fernando Valley, heading near the 5 and the underpass, and the fluorescent lights were all aglow, and I felt something wet, and I leaned forward, and I looked back, and the velour upholstery of the car was crimson with my blood, and I knew that that moment I was in trouble. So I drove, I remembered where Holy Cross Memorial Hospital is there on Rinaldi and Mission Hills, and I drove up to the hospital, and after I got the empty case of Löwenbräu out of the trunk, and I got the full case of Löwenbräu out of the trunk, because don't you know that when I take the drink takes the drink, and I'm off and running, and I got to have it, right? And the hardest thing to do when you're bleeding out is throw out a full case of beer. It was like no big shakes, because I knew what she was going to say. Timothy Carl, what are we going to do with you? And I pulled the car around, and I went into the emergency room, and they were looking at me, and two patrol officers came in from the Los Angeles Police Department, and they had some questions for me, and I didn't have any answers because, see, I was drunk and I was uncooperative. And they went on their way, and that's when my lung collapsed, and they admitted me to that hospital. And on the third day, I was laying in the bed. There she was. She didn't have to say it this time. She had that look on her face. My mom, Timothy Carl, what are we going to do with you? It was a couple moments after that, the two detectives came in from the Los Angeles Police Department, nice fellas in suits. They had some questions for me. Same questions those two patrol officers asked me. Did you recognize any of those guys? Did you get any names? Did they say anything you can remember? I couldn't remember nothing because I told you, I was drunk that night. And they said this: we suggest you go back to school and you forget this ever happened, because these are the kind of people who don't like witnesses, and there's absolutely nothing we can do to protect you. 16 years old. And it's not their fault. That's the way it is sometimes. And what I figured out is I was just running on borrowed time. I was just running on borrowed time. And I needed to get what I want, when I want it, as often as I can get it. And don't you know, Kendall, that's the third part of the problem. And in the middle of that is I always thought it was going to be different next time. And so if you're sitting in here and you have that thing where you take the drink takes the drink, and you're off and running into a blackout, into a jail, into another argument, into I can't remember what happened last night. Oh my God, they're calling me. It didn't go well. And I got this other thing where by Monday, you know, I'm tail between my legs. Tuesday, I'm kind of peeking around to make sure everything's okay. Wednesday, things are over. And by Thursday night, I'm drinking again. Because that's always going to be different next time. And isn't that what chapter 3 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is there to tell us? I just had an opportunity to speak at the Arlington meeting. So I'm going to take a step to the right here. I was up in Arlington. And Arlington is in a church on Wilshire Boulevard 10. And it is the oldest active speaker meeting west of the Rockies. It's been around since 1943, okay? And when you go to Arlington, they've got these books, and you sign your name in the book. And I am not worthy to sign my name in that book with the giants of Alcoholics Anonymous that are in that book. And there was a fella, a great friend of mine, Philo Hagen. He's not with us anymore, but he was the secretary the first time I talked at that meeting. And he wanted to make sure that I knew how that meeting ran, because they had structure, much like this meeting has structure. And so he brought me to their podium. He said, Tim, do you see that sign? I said, well, yes, I do. And he said, well, can you read that sign? I said, well, yes, Philo, I can. And he said, out loud. And on that podium, it says, under no circumstances will I use profanity from this podium. And he said, do you know what that means? And I said, yes, I will not use profanity from this podium. Good. Then he took me over and he showed me this sign. He said, can you read that sign? I said, yes. And he said, well, then do it out loud. It said, sobriety equals freedom from alcohol. He asked me, he said, do you know what that means, Tim? And I said, yeah, it means sobriety equals freedom from alcohol. He said, that's not what it means, Tim. What it means is, you can talk about drugs here, but if you do, you'll never get to this podium again, because they were serious about their singleness of purpose. And then he looked at me, just like Lee did, and he said, Tim, you look great. They love you already. Let's have fun up there. Because every group does a little bit different. So there I am, right? Scared to death. Running on borrowed time. I always think it's going to be different. And when I take the drink takes the drink and I'm off and running. And that goes on for a really long time. I end up getting married to a gal primarily because she drank the way I drank. She drank the way I drank was the common denominator in our relationship. And it was bad from the start. By the end, there was a note on the kitchen counter. It said, I can't do this anymore. And what she was talking about is she couldn't be married to me anymore. And that was probably 1999. And so she was gone, and then the dogs were gone, and then most of the furniture was gone, and all that was left was the defaulted mortgage and the unpaid credit card bills, and I was just drinking to get drunk. And then on February 11th of 2002, she called me up. We'd seen each other on and off, and I knew she wasn't doing well. She had a job, but she wasn't well physically, and she wasn't well mentally. And so I was drinking on that night. It was a Monday. She asked me if I'd come down to the place she was staying at, 19 Tanglewood in Aliso Viejo in Orange County, California. I know where that is today. Sometimes I go by and I pinch myself just to make sure it was all real. She had me come down to that house and we did some drinking, and she said she couldn't do this thing anymore. But this time she wasn't talking about being married to me. She was talking about living. She couldn't live this way anymore. And she didn't know what to do about it. And we ended up going to sleep that night. And I woke up the next morning and I couldn't find her in the house. And I went to the sliding glass door and I slid it open and I looked to the left at the air conditioning compressor, and she was crouched with a cigarette in one hand and a pale orange juice in the other. And if you be alcoholic, you know what that pale orange juice was at 7 a.m. in the morning. And I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm getting ready for work. And see, that's the way she'd been getting ready for work every day for a really long time. And we had a conversation. She said she wanted to see her doctor. And I agreed that I would take her to her doctor. We went down to her physician, and she was in there with her doctor for about 45 minutes. And the doctor came out and sat with me and said, do you have any idea how much your wife's drinking? I didn't have any idea how much I was drinking. And she said, she's drinking a half gallon of vodka every 2 days. Now, I know that for some of you, you know, that's nothing. But I was startled because I wasn't counting my drinks. And neither was she. And then the doctor did this thing, handed me a piece of paper, a script, and it had one word on it, detox. And my heart stopped. My heart didn't stop because she might have to go to the hospital. It didn't stop because she might have to get sober. It stopped because if she got sober, that meant I might have to get sober. And I'd been running my life using alcohol as a crutch for 27 years. And I didn't have any prior experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew what it was because I'd heard about it. I'd seen it in movies. But I had no concept of what sobriety was. And I had this friend in college. Great guy. Great guy. The kind of guy you want to drink with. He was the kind of guy that always had a bottle of Jägermeister in his freezer. So that when it was 2:30 and you were coming back from the bar, he was good to go. He was well armed with the facts about himself. Because when he took the drink took the drink and he was off and running. Always had a bottle of Jägermeister in his freezer. Probably about, oh, I don't know, 1999. Especially after she disappeared. You know, she didn't disappear. I chased her out. You know, but she was gone. And in that time frame, and, you know, I'd be drinking with this fella. And then he'd disappear for like 30 days. I couldn't get a hold of him. And then he'd come back and we'd do some drinking. And then he'd disappear for like 60 days. Then he'd come back and we'd get back to drinking. And then he'd disappear for like 90 days. And he never came back to drink. So on that morning of February 12th of 2002, I knew exactly who to call. Because what he'd been doing in that 30 and that 60 and that 90 is he'd been relapsing. But he was going to see the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he kept coming back. And he was one of the strongest people I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous, still to this day, one of my big heroes. Because he knew that anytime, anywhere, someone reaches out for help, he wanted the hand of AA to be there. And for that, he was responsible. It was a Tuesday. I called him. I told him what was going on. He said, I'll call you back. I learned later that he talked to his boss and said that he had something he needed to do. He called me and he said, I'll be right over. And I went outside. She was getting her things together. And I was standing under a big palm tree. It's still there. And I had this sense of being wrapped in a warm blanket. And I heard a voice, not from the outside, not my own voice, but just a soft voice. And it said, it's going to be different, but it's going to be okay. And I know today that that's a spiritual experience. That flash of brilliance, that moment of clarity where the window opens just a little bit and you might get through it. It's what gets us to the phone. It's what gets us to the meeting. It's what gets us to treatment. But it's not sustaining. It's not sustaining. Those little glimpses of God's will for us, they're not sustaining. And I think our founders understood that, because if you read the first edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps different. It says having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, but they changed it in the second edition. And now it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And what's the difference? I already told you what my spiritual experiences are. That flash of brilliance, that moment of clarity. But that spiritual awakening is that idea or that concept. That it's more important that I do for you than I do for myself. That I give freely of what I've found here. That I be of maximum service to God and the people about me. That I live a life of steps, and I live a life of traditions, and I live a life of concepts. I am as fallible as they come. I am full of defects of character. But in January of the coming year, I will be back in Bismarck where it will be 30 below with a t-shirt that says Any Lengths Tour, because Kendall, I go to any lengths too. And more and more and more people down in Orange County are coming with us because they want to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they want the great adventure. They want the great adventure, just like we all do, in whatever form it comes. And for me, the day the big adventure was to get in the car and come up and see you folks. And thrilled inside to have that opportunity, not because I get to stand at the podium, but because I get to check in with people who know people I know and meet new friends, make new friends that I'm going to see along this road. It's crazy to me. I was talking to Lee. Lee said something about something. And I said, I know Dave, bank robber Dave, and I know this other guy, Shane M. And both of those fellows are part of the golden age of recovery in Lompoc Federal Prison. Living lives that are purposeful and meaningful in my community. Men who are shoulder to shoulder with me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Lee knows this fella. And then I was talking to Shane's wife, and she goes, oh, we're going to see you tonight because Amanda's taking a 10-year chip and we're coming to the meeting. I said, I can't go. I can't go because I get to go to Arroyo Grande. And I'm going to see Shane's friend Lee. And she goes, I know Lee. Please tell Lee that Jasmine says I love you. And isn't that the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous? We're not the kind of people who live this way, but it turns out that we get to. So she ends up in the spin dry. I like that. I like to call it the spin dry. Because, you know, the insurance company will pay for 72 hours, some of them, and that's it. And so she was in the spin dry, and I got a telephone call like sometimes we do when our loved ones end up in treatment. And I got a phone call from some administrator, some facilitator. They said, you can come see your loved one on Thursday, but you got to go to the family group meeting first. It's a rite of passage. It's a condition. You got to do this thing. And so I showed up at the family group meeting with a dozen roses to fix my marriage. See, because it was February the 14th. It was Valentine's Day. And that's the night she told me that she was never coming home. But I went back to that family group meeting. And I went back again. And the fellow who ran that group was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't tell everybody that. He told me after the meeting. He said, all these people come in here and they talk about the terror and destruction and anguish and all the stuff related to their alcoholic. And you come in here and you talk about the negative impact that alcohol has had on your life. Why don't you call that guy you called on February the 12th and see if he'll take you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And that's what I did. And I'm standing here because that's what I did. Not only that, but you see, willingness met the absence of it at that moment. Willingness met the absence of it. I hit a bottom. It wasn't bankruptcy. It wasn't divorce. It wasn't the credit card bill. It wasn't her telling me she didn't want to live. It wasn't her telling me that she didn't want to live with me. The bottom is where willingness meets the absence of it, because I made a decision to do something that I ordinarily would not have done. It was a surrender. So if you go to Bismarck, Kendall, on the back of the t-shirt, it says, where willingness meets the absence of it, because I got good sponsees and they know how to make t-shirts. And so I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I called that guy. And there was a lady in there. She was sitting, being quiet, knitting. My mother used to knit. And then somebody said something, and I heard that. And then somebody said something else, and I heard that, and I was home. I felt home. I felt safe and protected in the palm of God's hand through the language of the heart, the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would go to meetings and not drink no matter what. And I would go to meetings and not drink no matter what. And I would go to meetings and not drink no matter what. Half measures. See, because abstinence ain't sobriety. So every time I see that in the book where Bill uses the word sobriety and I'm working with my people, I make sure they understand the difference between abstinence and sobriety, or abstinence and recovery. See, because for a long time I was just going to meetings, not drinking no matter what, working on my 3-minute pitch, trying to impress you. Some people call them dead cat meetings, because people come and they talk about their dead cat and they don't talk about recovery. And I was living that way. And she, you know, the first one, we got divorced, and then I found another one. Another suitable victim. And I forgot to tell that one that I owed the IRS in sobriety or post February 12, 2002, $275,000 from 2007, 2008. And we got married. And I do my own tax returns on guesses and estimates using TurboTax on the last day of the last extension, and then try and chase down the second wife to get her signature so I could get to the post office. And then not having the money, because you see, I wasn't paying the quarterlies. And it'd be another $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 every year. And things were looking good on the outside. When you're spending the government's money, you could live a really good lifestyle. And I'd been through audits. I was audited for 09 and 10. It was going to be different this time. Don't you know? I'm going to learn to control and enjoy the IRS. And the number got bigger and bigger and bigger. And by 2016, it was about $750,000. And I was going to meetings and not drinking no matter what. And I wasn't working a program. And I wasn't sponsoring people. And I wasn't doing a daily inventory. I was not praying. So there was no, I mean, I did a 4-step inventory with a guy where I did 3 columns and came to the rapid conclusion that it was still all your fault. No 10, no 11, no 12. Just eking out an existence, hoping that it was going to be different next time. And then in March of 18, it was early March of 2018, I got a little notice, one of the little letters from our friends at the Internal Revenue Service, and they wanted to perform another audit. And I knew it was going to be a disaster. I figured conservatively that if they audited the years that I had prepared, that $750 would very rapidly grow to $1 million. And I had $3.5 million of life insurance. And these images started to come into my head. See, because when I was in the United States Naval Reserve, in order to get from San Diego to Coronado to get to the ACB-1 base where I was a reserve at, you had to cross over the Coronado Bay Bridge. It's tall. My friend Carl M. talks about talking a fella off of that bridge. But see, that bridge was coming into my head. And when you got to get from Long Beach to San Pedro, you got to cross over the Vincent Thomas Bridge. And that bridge started to come into my head. And then the other bridge started to come into my head, because you see, in 1967, we were in the station wagon. My oldest sister, Vicky, and I were in the back seat of the Ford Country Squire. And there was five kids and my parents. And we were coming from Marin into San Francisco. And Vicky and I watched a lady jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And the image of that started to come back into my head. Haunting images. Because you see, I'm not brave enough to take a drink and come back. I was looking for the easy way out. I knew that if I did something like that, that the life insurance would pay off. She could pay the Internal Revenue Service. She could pay off the mortgages. She could have a decent life. And whether it be the tennis pro or the pool guy or some other knucklehead in AA, who cares? I was just so afraid of you folks finding out the truth. And this thought came. Call Mitch. Mitch was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who would talk openly about the trouble that he was having and how he was actively working a program of recovery and that he was making it. He was making it. Not in the sense that his economic problem was being solved the way he wanted it to be solved, but he was comfortable in his own skin. He would talk about how, you know, it all went away in an instant and he was loading bags of Milton's chips on the floor on the bottom shelf, and that was his job, and that he'd have to scrape together $10 or $15 from friends in the program just to get gas so he could get home to his wife. But he was working with people and he was doing the program, and I heard that guy. And on you know, shortly after I got that audit notice, I was driving down Barranca to my office, and that moment of clarity, that spiritual experience, call Mitch. And I called him. I said, what's going on? I told him. I said, when's the last time you've done a fear list? I've never done a fear list. I was just coming to meetings and not drinking no matter what. He said, I want you to write down what you're afraid of, and I want you to call me back. And willingness met the absence of it because I did it. And I called him back and I read it to him. She's going to leave. They're going to take the house. I'm going to lose my professional license. I'm going to end up in federal prison. And worst of all, when I get out, nobody's going to like me. And he said, is any of that going to happen by 5 o'clock? And I said, no. And he said one of the most profound things I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's just aim for midnight. And we do it all the time. We do it all the time. Whether it's the drinking, or it's the financial issue, or it's the relationship issue. If we're working a program of recovery, we're doing it all the time. I want to read something to you. Some of it will sound familiar. If I pick the right one, we never know what we're going to read. Ain't that, it's not that one. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace. Taking, as he did, this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Amen. And it wasn't until I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous that I figured out that the second part of the prayer is where we got one day at a time. And that's all Mitch wanted me to do, was take it one day at a time. And so he asked me, are you willing? Willingness had met the absence of it, and I was ready. And so we got together and we did a first step inventory. And what we did is we read the doctor's opinion, and some of this stuff wasn't new to me, but I was willing to do whatever this man asked me to do because he had what I wanted. And the it was the ability to walk through the trials and tribulations of his life successfully without the need to take a drink or kill himself, just like Bill Wilson talks about on the bottom of page 14 in the top of page 15 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mitch had what I wanted. I just wanted to be okay in my skin. And so we did what we do around here. We read the doctor's opinion together. We read Bill's story and we read chapter 3. And then we read the first chapter in the 12 and 12. First two words in the 12 and 12. He had me, you know, we do this thing around here where I read a paragraph, you read a paragraph. And so he read the first part and I read the first paragraph and it starts out, who cares? And he stopped me right there. Whole sentences, who cares to admit complete defeat? But Mitch said, who cares is your problem, drunk or sober? Who cares what the IRS thinks? Who cares what the judge thinks? Who cares what your first wife thinks, a second wife? Those crummy employees, those lousy customers. Who cares? And Mitch said, until you change who cares into I care, nothing's gonna change. You're gonna keep getting what you're getting. Probably deservedly so. My friend Patty Ochoa used to say, Tim, if you got what you deserved, you'd get 2 years in the electric chair. Wow. My friend Darren P. from Santa Barbara is a good friend of mine. And he had a similar situation when he was drinking. There's a bridge here that I've been over. And it's that, I forget what it's called, but it's down by the tavern. It's the big green bridge as you're crossing one, whatever State Street becomes. And so it's not uncommon in Alcoholics Anonymous, drunk or sober, to have experiences where things get so seemingly desperate that we talk in our heads about doing things that are irrevocable. And one of the things that I've learned is that part of my story is this, and I have to be willing to tell people this, because you never know who's out there who needs to hear it, that it's gonna be okay. It's gonna be different, but it's gonna be okay. And so we did that first step inventory, and we talked about the nature of insanity, and clearly I was insane, thinking that it would always be different next time. We talked about the idea of God. He had me do this exercise where I looked at the five great religions to see what the common thread was, and don't you know it was love? That simple idea, that concept, that it's more important that I do for you than I do for myself. And doesn't Bill say that? 1476, 88, I should give those people in Cleveland and Akron some credit too, because they helped write the book. But on 1476 and 88, it says faith alone. It does not say that. It says faith without works is dead. But on 93, it says to be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and constructive selfless action. And that's the core message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not about not drinking. And then we looked at that four step. And we went through the instructions. And he showed me in there where there's a four-column inventory, and when I get done with those three columns, I'm to say that sick man prayer, that I be divorced of all the malice, ill will, and the hatred that I have for those people, so I can see clearly what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes, just like Dr. Paul talked about in his story. And then we talked about that fear list again, and he said, I want you to write down what you're afraid of. I want you to write down whether it's real or if it's imagined. And if it's imagined, I want you to ask God to remove it immediately, because there's no sense being afraid of monsters under your bed. But if it's real, panic. He didn't say that, Kendall. He said, make a plan. What's the plan? We're going to ask God for the knowledge of His will for us. And once we make that plan on a daily basis, we're going to ask for the power to carry it out. And so it looks something like this. Hire an accountant. Hire a bookkeeper. Hire an interface with the Internal Revenue Service. You're probably not going to prison because all you did was not pay them and you're just an idiot. But hire a lawyer. So those things were written down. Right? But we talked about that fear list in that manner. And then we answered, then we looked at the nine questions as outlined on page 69 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if I didn't have a resentment against that person, or I didn't have a fear involving that person, if I looked at my relationships with other people, whether they be sexual relationships or not, that I would gain more clarity on what needed to be changed in me and in my attitudes. Where was my pride, my anger, my greed, my gluttony, my lust, my envy, my sloth, my selfishness, my self-centeredness, my dishonesty, my fear? And I got it all down on paper and I read it to him. And then we got busy. I started to pay the IRS. And then he said, you're going to get busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I had changed, I had started to have something that other people wanted. That ability to walk through calamity with a sense of courage and a sense of purpose. And they started to come. And I sat down with them. And we did it exactly as Mitch had shown me. And then I got involved in general service. And I took a commitment as a GSR. And then somebody quit. And next thing I know, I'm the secretary. And the next thing you know, I'm the alt DCMC. And then I got an Area 9 commitment. And I was working hard at work. And we were making arrangements with them. And I was paying them the money because it was in the plan. And as I stand here right now, that $1 million, because some fell off the back. That's not God, that's called luck. About 300, that 350 fell off the back. But right now we're sitting somewhere around $90,000. Because the amends process was to make the amends that I owed that wife and the amends that I owed the United States government, in addition to a bunch of other people. But I got busy. And I got a life where I'm thrilled to get in the car. I'm a yes and okay guy. Johnny Harris used to say, if it's open on my calendar and I'm not doing anything, that means I'm not doing anything else, AA. The date's yours. Yes and okay. And that's the kind of life that I try and live today. I'm far from perfect. I'll tell you this. I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore to get a life beyond my wildest dreams. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous so the new man or the new woman who walks through that door can have a life beyond their wildest dreams. My name's Tim Ayers. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.
Well, you know, give it up again for Tim.